open up the Google Doc, if you will, please. And
Where is the Google Doc?
Okay, so if you didn't get the Google Doc already, then you're going to need to refresh your browser and go to the Pass the OT website and access the chat option to request the Google Doc.
Actually, I was able to get it. I just went back in the chats and I saw it.
Okay, perfect.
Thank
no problem.
You.
Okay, perfect. So we're going over Module 4 today. So there's a lot of information in Module 4. The two most important topics I find that most people have trouble with as far as in questions on practice quizzes are going to be the Ranchos Los Amigos scale and spinal cord injuries. In the Google Doc, I sent you a very simplified, modified chart of the RLA and spinal cord injury. We're going to quickly work our way through both of the charts, kind of give you some tips and pointers on better ways to kind of memorize the different levels and what's going on and almost, you know, what's really important to know for test questions. So we're going to go ahead and start methodically with the Ranchos Los Amigos scale. So I always say to start with level 4 and 5 on the RLA because that's when people start participating in ADLs. So at both level 4 and 5, people are going to be on max assist for ADLs. Now, as you go up in the scale, obviously the level of assistance goes down by 1. So it's pretty easy to kind of work your way through and say, okay, 4 and 5 is max assist, 6 is mod assist, 7 is min. So let's kind of go back to Ranchos Los Amigos level 6. So, Melanie, why don't you go ahead and give me a few things that are happening at level 6 that are pretty important for somebody with a TBI?
Level 6, they're confused, but they're appropriate. They have an appropriate response.
Very good. Tadu, can you give me a little more information on level 6? Maybe add a little bit?
This is where they still need help on structure. And let's say if you're giving them a project to complete, it's best to show to guide them, and then verbal help as well, like cue them and give them a finished product of the task that needs to be completed.
Yeah, very good. So a couple more important things kind of to note about level 6. People have 30 minutes of concentration and ability to focus on a task. So that is a huge change from level 4 and 5 when you only can do quick 5, 10-minute activities with them. Also, they have acquired the ability to learn new things. Again, another huge turning point for somebody with TBI. Now, in OT sessions, we can start working on orientation skills, cognitive reintegration activities. We can start doing all of those challenging activities to hopefully help increase their cognition and memory skills to move them along in the RLA scale. Level 7 is going to be a min assist for ADLs. Level 8 is standby assist. Level 9 is standby assist on request. Fallon, do you want to tell me the difference between level 9 standby assist on request and level 8 standby assist? You want to take a stab at that?
I'm sorry, I'm still trying to pick up the document.
Okay, well, we'll skip ahead. Eleonora, why don't you go ahead and answer the question?
So between level 8 and 9, I guess at level 8, you're just standing there and making sure that the patient is safe, whereas at level 9, they're now able to ask you if they need help, so they're more aware.
Bingo.
Yeah, so huge difference between 8 and 9 with insight into disabilities and safety awareness and judgment. People who are a level 8 have very, very poor insight and very, very poor safety awareness and judgment. They should not be left alone for long periods of time, and they should not be doing complicated tasks where safety is an issue. You know, they shouldn't be deep frying food in the kitchen by themselves. They shouldn't be outside cleaning the gutters out by themselves. Somebody who is a level 9 has the ability to say to themselves, okay, this is an unsafe activity. I don't have great balance. I shouldn't do this while I'm alone. I'm going to wait for my spouse to get home and assist me. So a really big difference between the activities that you're doing with somebody at a level 8 versus a level 9.
Okay,
so
can I reiterate?
Sure.
Yeah, can I reiterate that? So level 9, they're aware when they need safety, when there is something is not safe, versus level 8, they're not aware of if something is safe or not?
Exactly. They have poor insight and poor safety awareness and judgment at level 8. A lot of the times they feel because they used to be safe doing those things that they're able to do them again.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, level 10, you're welcome, is going to be a modified independent. So, Jenny, do you want to go ahead and tell me, what does modified independent mean from a memory and a cognitive standpoint?
So, modified independent is that's when you need longer time or, like, adaptive equipment or something to assist with the task. So, like, memories, stuff like calendar, to-do list,
mm-hmm.
like an appointment book, things like that, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. So we're using visual cues. We're using environmental cues. It could be as simple as sticky notes placed around the house reminding to put the dog out at 10 a.m., things like that. Or it can be more sophisticated, like, you know, iPhone reminders or Google Home or Alexa, kind of setting up almost an environmental control unit for somebody to stay on task and make sure that they don't get into medications or, again, when to let the dog out, things like that. Very good. All right, let's move right along to the spinal cord injury levels. Now, again, like the Rancho Los Amigos chart, this is a very, very simplified, watered-down chart of the spinal cord injury, which I find needs to be very, very helpful when you're feeling overwhelmed with a lot of information. Let's go ahead and start at spinal cord injury level 6, or C6. So, Judith, why don't you tell me what's happening that is a huge deal with somebody who's a C6 spinal cord injury?
So someone with a C6 spinal cord injury will be able to extend the wrist, and that is why they are able to use the tenodesis sling to do their ADL. And the tenodesis is like when they have wrist extension, the fingers will passively flex so they can be able to grasp on items easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent. So they have
and then they have the tricep, so they can be able to block their hands behind and do the sliding bar transfer.
That's C7.
Yes, excellent. Thank you. So C6, we have kinesthesis. If everybody puts their elbow up on the table or wherever you're sitting right now, you let your wrist lie limply forward and you bring it back into extension, your fingers will automatically flex in. That's kinesthesis. So essentially a non-functional hand at C5, now at C6, is functional because of that kinesthesis grasp. However, because it is so hard to actually functionally do something with that, you know, like adjust your clothing or maybe even move like a remote control around, we provide them with a tenodesis splint. So the tenodesis splint locks the wrist in extension, and it makes the flexion of the fingers much easier to manipulate objects and functionally, you know, adjust your clothing and things like that. So, Emily, why don't you tell me what is the most effective piece of adaptive equipment for somebody at a C6 level used for grooming and feeding activities?
I only know the tenodesis splint for, for what activities? For combing hair?
Yes, for grooming maybe, and self-feeding.
Maybe like a long-handled stuff? I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Good guess. So the universal cuff is going to be the most effective piece of adaptive equipment. Remember, a tenodesis splint is not technically a piece of adaptive equipment. It's an orthotic device.
So I have a question on that. Why would you need a universal splint if you have a tenodesis splint because you have tenodesis function?
So for the more fine motor activities, you know, like applying makeup or flossing your teeth or, you know, trying to cut meat, for those activities, it's very hard to do using just a tenodesis reflex, even a tenodesis splint.
Mm-hmm.
So the U-cup just makes it much easier, and it's less work. So, you know, with, like, self-feeding activities, self-feeding is not something people want to struggle with, nor do they want it to take a really long time, because by that, at that point, your food would be cold, and it's not going to be enjoyable. All right, let's
go
ahead.
I have a question.
Yep, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Aren't you able to use a universal cuff at C5?
Yes, sometimes at C5, depending on if it's an incomplete or a complete injury, a universal cuff can be effective as well. Let's go ahead and skip to C8 spinal cord injury. I'm going to go back to the top of my list, and I'm going to ask Melanie, what is happening at C8 that's important to note?
Hello?
Melanie?
Oops, sorry, I had it on mute.
Oh, that's okay.
They have full upper extremity use, and they're independent with feeding and grooming tasks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So C8, I always give, like, a little bit of an odd visual, but I say the best way to know what's going on where in the body is to kind of try to visualize it with spinal cord injury. And it starts at C8 when we really can start visualizing, like, the level of impairment, what's happening. I always say try to visualize a Ken doll. Even though he's not anatomically correct, he's nice and flat. So break Ken doll's arm off, and that's a C8. That's what you have use of right there, that arm. So you don't have any trunk control at C8. You don't have any pectoralis major or minor innervation control. You just have that arm. So an important thing to know as far as exam questions go, at C8 is the level where people can enter into a driver rehab program. Because they do have full use of their upper extremities, they can use hand controls in vehicles.
And also for depression lifts and for your sores, right? Your bed sores or your...
Yes. Yep, they could be doing the pressure relief as well. You can be shifting side to side at C6 level using your elbows. Okay, let's go on to T1 through T12, the thoracic spine.
So I have a question.
Sure.
You have full use of your fingers on C8, correct? I got a little confused. Okay.
Yes.
But you said something about the thumb not being able to be used?
Nope, you have full use of your upper extremity.
Okay,
so
thank you.
T1 through T12. Yep, no problem. T1 through T12 is the thoracic spine. The majority of questions that you will find in practice quizzes and on the exam are going to be about trunk control, or you're going to have to think, where on the body is this injury and how much trunk control does a person have? So T1 through T3 starts right about the nipple line, like on a Ken doll. So picture it right there, and it goes all the way down to just above the pubic bone. So that section of your body is your thoracic spine. T10 is going to be about your belly button. T6 is going to be right where the sternum ends and the ribs meet. That gives you kind of a good idea. So if I asked you, where is T8 spinal cord injury, Tadu, what would you tell me?
I would say that it's around the belly button area.
Yeah, so
they
just above the belly button. Yep.
Right,
yep.
Just above
so the
belly button.
About T10. So T8 would be a couple inches above that. So you would know somebody who has a T8 spinal cord injury will have decent trunk control at that point.
Right.
Okay. So let's go ahead and skip down to section 2 of the Google Doc. So on section 2 of the Google Doc, it's a quick tutorial on how to effectively break down questions. So again, I'm going to go through this kind of quickly. If you have questions, further questions about, like, dissecting questions apart, then I highly or strongly recommend scheduling a one-on-one tutoring session where you can really get that one-on-one attention and go through it slowly and methodically. But for the purpose of the group, we're just going to go quickly. So the first step whenever you read a multiple-choice question on the exam is always going to be to ask yourself, what kind of information are they looking for? And when I say they, I mean MBCOT. What kind of information are they looking for from me? So there's three different types of multiple choice questions on the OTR exam. The first type is intervention seeking. So those are questions where they're seeking for you to know the appropriate intervention. The second type of question is a grading question. So again, that falls under the intervention category because when you grade an activity, you are coming up with an intervention. However, there's a little bit of a different formula to help you solve those grading questions. And the formula is this. You always are choosing an activity that is the same, and you're adding one degree of difficulty to it. So the trick in those questions becomes picking out the measurable pieces in the original activity and making sure you're grading those measurable pieces up one. Okay, type three are information seeking or what would you do questions. So these are your non-applied questions. So most of the exam, probably 75%, is your applied knowledge. So applied knowledge is things you learned on fieldwork, how do we intervene as a practitioner with our clients with occupation-based and client-centered treatments. So non-applied knowledge is going to be just strictly asking you, for example, what is the CAWA frame of reference? These are a small percentage of the questions on the exam. However, they tend to be the most difficult to answer, especially if you're not super familiar with the information they seek. So if you're not familiar with the CAWA frame of references, unfortunately, you're going to have a hard time answering the question. The trick then becomes to kind of go about those questions backwards. And what you're actually going to want to do is, first of all, focus on what you do know in the question. There's always going to be something you know in the question or the answers. So you're going to focus on that. And you're actually going to try to eliminate wrong answers first before you focus on what you think the right answer is. So, again, just going about some of those questions backwards will help make you more effective in feeling confident you found the best answer. Okay. So always remember, I know that a lot of you have probably been studying for a while and you're very focused on choosing safe answers for your clients and a client-centered answer. Also remember, a lot of the times they are looking for us to obtain objective information and then document our findings. Those are really true when you get those types of questions where it asks, what should you do first? What should you do immediately? And oftentimes I find people get very confused and very unsure. Just always remember, as a practitioner, what you need to be doing is obtaining objective information and documenting your findings. That's kind of like in the OT process, what you need to be doing in order to effectively, you know, treat your clients and document progress or whatever. All right, very, very good. So the next section, section three, I have six practice questions. They're about spinal cord injury and TBI. These are structured very similar to practice questions you find, at PACIOT and other sources. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have Fallon, I would like you to read me question number one. We're just going to focus on the question. I'm going to ask a few questions about the question, and then we're going to come up with an answer and kind of just practice dissecting this question apart. So this one's going to go a little slower than the others. So whenever you are ready, Fallon, go ahead.
I can't bring up the study material for some reason. I'm just listening now.
I could read the question for you.
Yep, we'll go ahead and skip down to Eleonora. Go ahead, Eleonora, and read me the first question, please.
Okay. An OTR is working with a patient who suffered a C6 spinal cord injury as a result of a boating accident. The patient's goal is for more independent self-feeding. Which following piece of adaptive equipment will be most useful in achieving this goal?
Okay. So the first thing you should be asking yourself with this question is, what are they looking for? What type of question is this? So, Jenny, what type of question is this, or what are they looking for in this question?
Are they looking more for, like, adaptive equipment, more like intervention?
Yes, perfect. I'm so happy you said that. So this is an intervention. The key word is adaptive equipment. So there are keywords in every single question that you need to make sure you're not missing. And those keywords really help drive your answer. So we are looking for a piece of adaptive equipment for somebody who is what? What's the diagnosis?
C6 spinal cord.
Yes, C6 spinal cord injury. So, Judith, why don't you go ahead and get rid of two wrong answers for me and tell me why.
Well, I'm going to go the first one, built up foot and spoon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going, because this is a patient with a C6 spinal cord injury, so it's not like he has a problem with grasping, but you need a build up utensil, so I'll take that out. And then I'll go take out the last one, which is mechanical feeding device, because the C6 client can extend the hand, but this one is for, the mechanical feeding goes for, I think, for C5, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yes, very good. So we have a push-up fork and spoon and a mechanical feeding device. And for most multiple choice questions, whether there's three or four choices, we can always easily eliminate at least one or two choices. So now we're left with two. So I want everybody to kind of think about between the UCOS and the Tianidista split, which piece of adaptive equipment is most useful for a C6 spinal cord injury. So everybody kind of just tell me what you think it is.
That's the cuff.
Universal cuff.
Universal cuff.
Yes, universal cuff. Perfect. So the key word was adaptive equipment. And we discussed previously that a tenodesis splint is not a piece of adaptive equipment. Now, this is how tedious or how specific some of these questions can actually be. And you find that little key word, and it almost seems like it's a trick. And you realize, wow, that question is actually super easy, or if I hadn't really paid attention to that, I might have chosen tenodesis splint instead because my brain is so programmed to think tenodesis, C6, spinal cord injury.
I have a quick question. Did you say the tenodesis splint was if it's not adaptive equipment?
It's actually an orthotic device.
Okay, thank you.
Perfect. All right. Number two. Let's go ahead. Melanie, why don't you go ahead and read? Or no, Melanie, you already read. Were you able to read the first question? I'm sorry.
I didn't read the first question, but I can read the second.
Yes, that sounds great. Thank you.
During an evaluation with a 20-year-old man who recently suffered a TBI as a result of a motor vehicle accident with reported LOC states, loss of consciousness. I don't see the point in occupational therapy. There's nothing you can do to help me. Which of the following is he displaying?
Oh, goodness. Okay. So, what type of information, Tadu, why don't you tell me, what's the information MBCOT or whoever wrote this question, what are they looking for?
They're looking for the state of cognition for this 20-year-old for his answer.
Yeah, it's information seeking. So this is one of those non-applied questions. So it's just basically being able to know what each one of those answers means. So, Fallon, why don't you tell me, what is executive function disorder?
Oh, me? Sorry.
No, I said Fallon, I called on. Is she still on the call?
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm sorry. I'm, like, so lost.
Oh, no, that's okay. Yeah, executive function disorder. You want to take a stab at it?
No, go ahead and choose someone else.
Okay, so let's pretend, let's use this as a learning experience. So let's pretend, Fallon, you got a question like this on the exam, and one of the answers you're like, I have no clue what that means. So
right.
A lot of us might kind of feel really bad and think, I don't know, I'm going to get this wrong. So I always say focus on what you do know, okay? So if there's something you don't know in an answer or even in the question, move on from that. So go to the next one. So rationalization. What does it mean to rationalize something?
Like justify?
To think it through?
So when we rationalize our behavior, for instance, what do we do?
Is it like giving a meaning to what we are doing?
So when we rationalize behavior, it's often giving an excuse or giving, you know, say you were really, really grouchy one day to some of your coworkers, and maybe you snapped at them and you were maybe a little inappropriate. And then when somebody calls you out on it, you say something like, well, I didn't get enough sleep last night, so I came into work really tired, and that's why I'm so grouchy. So you're rationalizing your behavior, even though your behavior is inappropriate, and most of us in the adult world would just own up to that inappropriate behavior and apologize. So does anybody care to take a snap at what denial is?
Denial is when you don't want to agree on something that happened to you and you're not willing to accept it because it's so shocking to you or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, potentially denial could be something like somebody says, oh, you're being really grouchy today. And you say, no, I'm not. So you're denying the fact that maybe your mood isn't what it normally is. Okay. So we have this client in the question with a TBI, with a loss of consciousness, and they're saying, I don't want to participate in OT. It's not going to help me. Which one of those terms has to do with TBI?
Denial.
No. Denial.
So rationalization and denial are both mental health issues, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. This patient has a TBI. Which one has to do with TBI?
Then it's, in that case, it's executive function disorder.
Executive function disorder, exactly. So this is a perfect example of a very tricky information-seeking question that kind of tricks you into thinking, oh, this sounds like denial, or this sounds like rationalization, when really what it comes down to is this patient has a TBI. He's saying he doesn't understand how occupational therapy can help him. He doesn't see the point. That's the definition of executive functioning disorder. With executive function disorder, you have the inability to see your own areas of weakness because of the TBI.
I'm sorry, Jessica?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Isn't executive function disorder like whenever the patient is unable to like schedule or organize and plan
problems?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Those two are parts of executive function disorder. Very, very common disorder with people with an acute TBI injury can display those difficulties.
So is there a section where it explains which ones are mental health issues and which ones are TBI issues in the course?
So in the modules, it does go through the different levels of TBI, the Rancho Los Amigos scale on module 4. You will get information like that. However,
okay,
if you are doing questions and things come up in the practice questions that you are really unfamiliar with, what I always recommend is putting it on a flashcard and making sure you go back to that term, you go back to that whatever it is, and you define it for yourself, and you make sure you have a great understanding of it, because if it pops back up again in your exam, you'll be very confident in what it means. All right, let's go on to number 3. Eleonora, why don't you go ahead and read that for me?
Okay. You are working with an adolescent with spina bifida. They use a wheelchair for mobility and require max assistance for all transfers, bathing, and dressing tasks. Their parents are remodeling their home. Which modification would be most important for the occupational therapist to suggest?
Okay. Jenny, why don't you go ahead and get rid of one wrong answer for me and tell me why.
So I was going to go with a shower chair with wheels for bathing.
Okay.
I'm not sure, honestly, but for some reason that was one answer that I didn't think was right.
So in this question, when you read it, what you're thinking is an occupational therapist is kind of the key word. What do we as OTs, what do we bring to the table for our clients? So that's super important with MBCOT. That's the whole occupation-based functional answers. We need to make sure we're choosing answers that are exclusive or unique to occupational therapy. So it's kind of first and foremost. And second is obviously going to be client-centered. Well, in this instance, client-centered really doesn't apply that much because the client hasn't really stated their goals in the question. So in this question, we are just pretty much information-seeking and what you as the OT would suggest for the family. So we get rid of a shower chair with wheels because it asks for a modification. And a shower chair with wheels really isn't a modification. It's more an assistive device. So it doesn't really fit our criteria as the best answer necessarily. Okay, so go ahead, Judith. I want you to get rid of one more wrong answer and tell me why.
Jessica, that one is tough.
Yeah, I know. It's hard, isn't it? So what is your gut telling you, Judith?
Okay, I'll go with a ramp to enter and exit using the front door.
Uh-huh, yeah. Why does everybody think the ramp to enter exit the front door? Why is that not a great OT recommendation, even though it's super helpful, right? Sometimes these questions have more than one right answer. However, it's not the best answer. Does somebody care to take a stab at why that might not be the best answer?
I have a suggestion. Is it because it costs money and it's not cost effective?
Yeah, that is one thing for sure. That's one thing to always think about when answering questions. Also, a ramp might be considered something more like a physical therapist would be recommending. Because physical therapists sometimes in the home health setting tend to focus on mobility and accessing the home. So the better answer or the best answer is going to be a zero-entry shower stall with a handheld shower head. That's where we as OTs really shine, is helping our clients be as independent as possible with their activities of daily living. And what's a bigger activity of daily living than bathing and dressing? This client is max assist for those activities, which doesn't mean somebody's totally doing the activity for them. They are able to participate. So a zero-entry shower stall would help them participate as much as possible. All right. And very good. All right.
Jessica?
Yep.
What is a zero-entry shower stall?
So a zero-entry means that there is no lip. You just walk right in. So the drain is kind of sunken in a little bit, so the water can drain down.
So pretty much like a walk-in shower?
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was having a hard time with. I was like, what is that?
Yeah. So things like that show up on the exam, right? Sometimes there's things where you're like, I have no clue what that means. So, again, I'm going to preach, and I'm going to go back to what I originally said. Focus on what you do know. Okay. All right, so Tedo, would you like to read question number 4, please?
Yeah, which is the most effective strategy to use while teaching a client with the TBI who is in Rancho Los Amigos level 8 how to tie their shoes independently?
Oh, goodness. Okay, Tedo, what kind of question is this? What information are we looking for?
We're looking for information on the Rancho Los Amigos, so it's information seeking.
Very good. Very good. Information seeking.
And it has a lot to do
with the diagnosis.
He has a TBI.
Mm-hmm. And what's the problem?
The problem is that they're at a high level of Rancho Los Amigos, so they're able to do many things on their own. And in order for them to do it independently, you have to think, okay, which one of these answers are going to be ones that are just independent? That's what you're looking for in this question.
All right. Very, very good. All right. So, Fallon, do you care to take a stab at what backward-chaining approach? Would you like to describe what backward-chaining approach is?
Yeah, backward chaining is compensating. Is it
okay?
It's restorative.
So let's think about backward and forward chaining. A really easy way to kind of think about those two approaches is what it says is what you do, what the client does. Mm-hmm. So in backward chaining, the client does the back first, so they do the last step. Okay, so if we're doing a three-step activity, we as the OT will do step 1 and 2. Our client will complete step 3. So why would having our client complete the last step in an activity be a useful way to teach a difficult activity or a difficult skill? Why would that be useful?
It'll help the client to see success at the end of
the very accomplished, right? Because they finished a difficult activity. So it's very rewarding.
Yes.
It's almost like a positive reinforcement. Very good. All right. Eleonora, do you care to take a stab at what errorless learning technique is?
Sure. Let's see.
So pretend you're not really familiar with it. You're sitting on the test and you're like, I have no clue what that means. What would you take a guess that errorless learning technique might mean, just through its name?
I mean, just by looking at it, which I kind of am right now, I would say that it kind of doesn't, I know it's kind of like an easy thing that where you're giving the client something easy to do where they already know how to do it.
So we're definitely using activities with people that they can do without completing, without making an error, and we're correcting them when they do. So it's an extremely effective method to use with folks with TBI who are very, very high level and have identified that as a goal. So they've identified the fact that they want to be able to tie their shoes without making a mistake. It can also be very stressful. Be extremely stressful to use a stressful method to use, because sometimes people aren't very receptive to hearing every time they make an error, and then they don't want to participate in the activity. Errorless learning technique are one of those things you have to kind of use with caution and make sure that the client is very high level and has that insight into their disability and they have really good awareness. So would you think somebody who's a level 8 on the Rancho System Ego scale would be receptive, or it would be appropriate to use errorless learning techniques?
Yep.
No. I think so.
No. I think it would.
It really depends on their personality, but it's kind of like one of those things, 50-50. Okay, let's talk about metacognitive skills training. So I'm just going to throw this out there. Does anybody have any idea what metacognitive skills training is?
Nope.
So I jumped into the call late. I'm Chris.
Okay. Hi, Chris.
Isn't that like when you have them run through the task, like, in their head, and then you have them do it?
No, you're not off base at all. Metacognitive skills training is specifically formulated for people with TBI, and it's to help develop self-awareness. So, again, it's a technique you use when they're a little higher level. So, higher level, when I say higher level TBI, I mean 6 and above, you know, and we're even creeping into like 7, where people have that attention to task, they have a little bit of insight, they have some focus, they're out of that aggravated state or that agitated state. So metacognitive skills training teaches people self-awareness and self-monitoring their performance. They also are able to identify errors that they make and self-correct themselves. So again, it can be extremely useful in people with higher level. So we've talked about kind of what each one of these choices mean: backward chaining, errorless learning, metacognitive skills. Our client has a TBA and they're a level 8. Would you like to take a stab at what you think is going to be the best approach for helping them tie their shoes independently out of all 3 of these choices?
Are you asking me?
Anybody.
Metacognitive skills training.
So, the thing to remember when you see questions on the exam or in practice and you see metacognitive skills training, it's going to be an extremely effective approach with people with higher level TBI injuries and helping them learn self-awareness and self-regulation. So, it's perfect for somebody who's a Rancho System Ego 8. As we discussed previously, they don't have great insight. They don't have great judgment. We want to teach them that. Sure.
So what's the answer? What is the answer now?
The answer is metacognitive skills training.
Oh, C is the
Why
answer.
Why are the other ones wrong?
Yes. So remember, yes, remember, they're not always wrong, right? There's sometimes better answers. And that's what gets really tricky with the multiple choice questions, and especially the ones with three answer choices. So you got to get really, really good at being able to identify, oh, metacognitive skill training is something we use specifically for patients with TBI who are higher level on self-awareness.
I just had a quick question, sorry. The backwards chaining approach, I felt like when I was doing practice questions and stuff, that was like a common like term I came across. And I thought it was pretty like useful towards like patients with cognitive issues. And I thought it was applicable for this.
Yeah,
can you kind of point out why?
Yeah, so that could be an effective treatment approach. However, in this question, it didn't really go into detail about what the client was having difficulty with, if anything. It just says we're trying to teach them how to be more independent with tying their shoes. So if the question was worded differently and it said something like you had taught the client over three sessions how to tie their shoes, you simplified it, and you were looking for a different approach to help them be more independent, then backward chaining approach could be very applicable. It might be the best answer in that case.
And,
but the question
and also,
go into all of that.
Also, you have to know that backward chaining approach, it's not independent because you have the therapist do the first couple steps and then have the patient complete the last one. So in essence, it's not independent.
That is true.
Initially, it's not independent. That's a very good point to bring up. And literally, that's how tricky some of these questions can get. They can get that nitpicky and that tricky. And getting really good at those nitpicky, tricky questions will help get you that 450 you need or raise your score if a raised score is what you're looking at. Okay.
I have a last question with that. So for the backward chaining approach, it almost reminds me of NFA, neurofunctional. Do you know what I'm talking about? The theory, NFA.
The neurofunctional approach, NFA.
Yes. Yes, it almost seems like that, and that would be why it would be good for TBIs, because it's a practice. It's through practice and habituation. Is that correct?
So remember, just really quick, side note for everybody who's wondering about neurofunctional approach, and then we'll move on with the questions. Neurofunctional approach focuses on function, not impairment, and it is used for clients with brain injuries, and it emphasizes a bottom-up approach. So backward chaining could be part of a neurofunctional approach, but it's not exclusive to that.
You said function, bottom up, and what?
Yep, it uses bottom up approach. So remember, bottom up focuses on deficits, not necessarily how those deficits affect our occupation.
Perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's go on to question number 5. Jenny, why don't you go ahead and read that for me?
Sure. What is the best frame of reference for the following scenario? Your client is discharging home in a week. She's a stay-at-home mother.
Oh, Jenny, can I just have you – Jenny, I'm just going to interrupt you.
Sure.
So some people don't have their calls on mute, and it's giving a lot of background noise. Could you just make sure your call is on mute if you're not talking? Oh, thank you. So much better. I appreciate it. All right, Jenny, I apologize. Go on, please.
No problem. Okay. Well, what is the best frame of reference for the following scenario? Your client is discharging home in a week. She's a stay-at-home mother and wishes to return to her responsibilities in performing the home management task and driving her children to and or from school and activities. At present, she's a RLA 8, purposeful, appropriate.
Oh, goodness gracious. So this is definitely information seeking in the fact that it's asking for a frame of reference, but it's also intervention seeking, right? Because you look at the answers and they're all interventions. So when we get to kind of two-part questions where it almost seems like a lot of information and it's kind of asking a couple of different things, again, focus on what you know. So let's go ahead and focus on where are we at in the OT process in this question? So, Judith, why don't you tell me, where are we at in the OT process?
Information seeking?
So we are information seeking, but in the OT process, meaning are we evaluating, are we treating, are we discharging, are we documenting, what are we doing?
We are discharging.
Discharging. Yeah, we're discharging this patient. So, Emily, why don't you tell me what's important in this rehab setting, because it's very apparent this is a rehab setting. What do we as OTs focus on when we're discharging our clients?
Is that, who is that for? Me?
Emily, yep.
What's the question?
What do we focus on when we're discharging our clients from a rehab?
Like how they are able to be supported at home, home evals and support from family, friends, things like
wonderful.
That.
So we're preparing our clients for home. So first and foremost always is like, what's your home setup? Where are you going to? What's it going to look like? And then you mentioned a really important one, family support. Who is going to be helping take care of you? What level of child,
right.
or what level of Ranchos Los Amigos is this mom? What is she?
She's
a level 8. Do you think it's a good idea for her to, upon discharge, resume her role as a stay-at-home mom and driving at a level 8?
It's on the edge, I think.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a great long-term goal. But it's probably not a great when you return home goal. Remember, level 8 has poor insight. They have poor safety awareness and poor judgment, and they require standby assist.
Right.
So the standby assist is going to be to remove barriers or obstacles in their way to remain safe. So that's what the standby assist is.
So she needs help to go to that long-term goal of doing it on her own.
Exactly. Okay, so here we've got stay-at-home mom. We know she's discharging. We're going to work on family training. We're going to work on maybe a home eval. She's probably, her goal of being resuming her role isn't really achievable right away, but it's definitely a great long-term goal. What are we going to do? So, again, this is a two-part question. We're looking for a frame of reference and an intervention. So frame of references are things that kind of scare everybody. So I always say focus on what you do know and focus on the intervention. So, Melanie, why don't you go ahead and get rid of 2 wrong answers for me and tell me why?
I think get rid of C because it says, remind her when to pick up the children, but I think we decided that she wouldn't be driving yet.
Driving might not be a good idea right upon discharge. She probably actually is going to have to go into a driver rehab program to prove that she's safe to drive, being that she has a PBI. Very good. What else can we get rid of?
D maybe?
Okay. Why are we getting rid of D?
Because it said, to have her use Google Home or Alexa to assist her and talk her through all tasks during her day, but I don't think she would need that.
She's going to need more than that. She needs standby assist. Google Home and Alexa, those are not standby assist, right?
Right. So for safety,
those are not enough
help.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, so now we have 2 answer choices. We have A and we have B. What does everybody think is the best answer?
C.
The ecology of human performance. Does anybody want to take a stab at describing what ecology of human performance means?
So ecology of human performance is when it's basically the context is the main thing driving the treatment. Am I correct?
Yep, you're definitely on the right track. Ecology of human performance is one of those frame of references that you read the definition and you kind of are left confused by what does that mean when put into practice. So what does that mean if I'm a therapist using the ecology of human performance frame of reference? What does that look like? So other frame of references can be a little easier, like the biomechanical frame of reference can be kind of easy to picture. So ecology of human performance chooses an activity based on your client's level of ability. You can grade that activity to the next level of difficulty as their skills increase. You can also provide your client with adaptive equipment, compensatory strategies, and modifications. So that's where it gets a little hairy, and you might think it sounds a little bit like occupational adaptation. So occupational adaptation compensates, modifies, and adapts, but what it doesn't do is it doesn't focus on remediating a client's deficit. Okay, so in this instance, a College of Human Performance is the correct frame of reference, and you didn't even really need to know that to answer this properly, because you can clearly see that the treatment or the intervention indeed made a lot more sense for where you were at in the OT process with your client.
I had a quick question, sorry.
Sure.
For choice A, I know like we picked B, but could you go over why as to A is not the right answer? Like towards the end, I was like stumbling between A and B, and somehow I picked B.
Yeah, so let's talk about cognitive behavioral. Does anybody want to take a stab at what cognitive behavioral approach is?
Based on your cognition, it determines the behavior that you'll be doing. And in this case, it breaks down what it is, and she's at a high level Rancho Los Amigos, and that's a lower level Rancho Los Amigos for cognitive behavioral frame of reference.
Okay, good. Does anybody want to add anything to that, the cognitive behavioral frame of reference?
Yeah, actually, isn't that like changing how you think in order to change your behavior like that?
Yeah, so Tether, you were definitely on the right track with that. And yes, it's definitely looking at what maladaptive behaviors are affecting or impeding independence. So we're going to look at, you know, and I don't want to say this like bad behaviors, but essentially bad behaviors that affect independence. So it's a really great frame of reference to use with folks in the mental health world. So people may be struggling with PTSD who are triggered very easily by things in their environment, and it could impede their independence with ADLs. So what always comes to mind for me really quickly is when I was a therapist working in a long-term care facility, I actually had a patient who was a Nazi war encampment survivor. And we had one big shower room at the time in the long-term care unit I worked in, and it reminded her of Nazi prison camps, and she was triggered into PTSD because of that. So, you know, weren't a lot of options at that point. So what we did was we took a shower in another section of the building where it wasn't a big, huge shower stall, so it didn't trigger her. So that's cognitive behavioral approach. You're focusing on those maladaptive behaviors that affect independence with ADL. So in this instance with somebody with a TBI, I'm not sure cognitive behavioral might always be the most appropriate frame of reference, especially when somebody has poor safety awareness in this instance. But it's certainly cognitive behavioral, certainly like from a home health standpoint, I think with somebody a little higher level could definitely be an effective approach. However,
you want
to come up with why you think the treatment. So the treatment of the question is you use positive reinforcement for each safe, correct decision she makes while completing a cooking task in the rehab kitchen. As in the past, she has been nervous whenever she makes an unsafe decision. So why do you think with somebody with an RLA that doesn't really fit? Anybody care to take a stab?
Because she's not aware she's unsafe?
Yes, exactly. RLA don't have that insight and that judgment. So us correcting unsafe decisions isn't necessarily going to carry over for her making safe decisions the next time because they lack that insight. All right, very, very good. Last one.
Can you just confirm which answer it is? I got a little bit lost.
That's okay. It's B, Ecology of Human Performance.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, Chris, I think it is, right? You joined in the call?
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't seem to access the link for, like, whatever research or the notes.
Yeah, you can go ahead to the chat option on the PathEOT website, and you can get the Google Doc that goes with it so you can catch up. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and have Fallon, why don't you read question number 6 for me?
I'm on past the OT website. I can't find the paperwork at all. This whole hour I've been looking for it.
Can I read the question for the people and then have them?
Yep. So go ahead, Jenny. Why don't you go ahead and read the question number six?
Where can I find it?
So when you go to the chat option on the Path EOT website, ask for the Google Doc for the group call.
Oh, I have to request it?
Yes, you do. It will get sent to you.
Oh, okay. Jessica, did you say you wanted me to read the question?
Yeah, Jenny, if you would, please.
Sure, no problem. While completing a standardized assessment during an evaluation as an OTS, notices their TI, spinal cord injury patient has suddenly broken out in a sweat and is complaining of an extreme headache. The student immediately checks the catheter bag and notices it is not bent. What should the supervising OT do next?
Okay. So, Jenny, what kind of question is this, or what information are they looking for?
I think it's more of, I know it's like, what do you do first? Is it like treatment?
Yeah, it's like a what would you do? Yeah, it's a safety. Mm-hmm. It's a safety question. These are those type 3 questions, information seeking or what would you do. They tend to be the hardest, and they tend to be the ones that we kind of focus on, reread over and over again, and you're kind of like, okay, I have no idea. So here's a little food for thought or a little pointer on these types of questions. You as the OT practitioner are always going to obtain objective information. You're going to make an assessment from your objective information and document your findings. So in this instance, the student checked the bag. Your client is uncomfortable. What objective information can we obtain from this situation? Anybody can answer that.
Don't we have to know what diagnosis, what is happening with the patient in order to know what to do in this case?
So we don't know. We have to make an assessment.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Since the spinal cord injury, we have to know that, okay, we checked the catheter line and it's not bent, so it's not something that's, what's it called? It's not a noxious stimulus. Exactly, on AD. So therefore, the next option in this case would have to be that it's the other one, not autonomic, it's orthostatic hypotension.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you right there. So here is the only problem with your line of thought, and I love the way you're thinking. I love how you're digging in deep, and you're really trying to figure this out. The question didn't ask what we think is wrong. The question asked, what should we do next? So whether or not they're having autonomic dysreflexia or orthostatic hypotension, that does not matter. The student checked the catheter bag. It's not bent, or the catheter line. Now we need to obtain objective information. So something is going on with our client, and we need to know what before we can do anything about it. So what information do we need?
Would you trust the student, or would you check the catheter bag again yourself?
Since it's a student, we would have to call a nurse, right?
Okay. No, so we're with the student. So we as the OT practitioners, we have to obtain exactly vital signs. That is our objective information. That is what tells us what's happening on the inside. Okay? So if the vital signs are normal, there's no emergency. The patient might just be coming down sick with a common cold, okay? If the vital signs are through the roof, that means they might be having autonomic dysreflexia, and we need to call 911 immediately because that is a medical emergency. So let's talk about, really quick before we hang up, let's talk about the difference between autonomic dysreflexia and orthostatic hypotension. Those are two common things that show up on the exam. Autonomic dysreflexia lets the body know something's below the level of injury, a pain stimulus, or something is wrong with the body. The problem is people with spinal cord injury have a very hard time regulating their vital signs. So that's why their blood pressure goes through the roof, and that's why their heart rate goes through the roof. You do not recline somebody back who has autonomic dysreflexia because that increases the blood flow to the brain, and it puts them at an even higher risk for seizure, clots, stroke. So orthostatic hypotension is a sudden drop in blood pressure, very commonly associated with folks who have been lying down for a long period of time, like in a surgery, and then they go to sit up. What happens is the blood drains rapidly from their brain so fast that they can actually pass out. So with somebody with orthostatic hypotension, you actually want to recline them back so the blood gets back to their brain.
Can I ask a quick question about the autonomic dysreflexia?
Mm-hmm.
So I know you said that's the one, like, well, we said earlier, we check the catheter to make sure there's, like, you know, nothing is, like, blocked. But do we also make sure the patient is kept upright because we can't, you know, have them recline?
Exactly.
We're
going to check, make sure their clothing is not restricted, they don't have something pinched in their wheelchair. We're going to do all that check. So remember, that's us obtaining objective information. So we have to do those steps before we automatically assume it's autonomic dysreflexia and dial 911. We need that information prior to.
Sweating and extreme headache has to do with autonomic dysreflexia. Is this correct?
Yes. Those can often be symptoms. Yeah.
Okay, and so therefore, when we check the catheter and we know that there's nothing, no noxious stimulus of the catheter, we know that it's not autonomic dysreflexia that they're going through. Therefore, we have to take the blood pressure and vital signs of the patient.
Well, we're not sure it's not autonomic dysreflexia. We just know that it's the catheter bag is safe. That's fine. So remember, autonomic dysreflexia is as a result to something not right below the level of injury. So it could be a variety of different things. So it could be like a blood clot. So that definitely is like inside the body. We don't know. Again, a medical emergency. Okay, so unfortunately,
we are out of time.
So I'm going to have to end the call.
Okay, just a quick question.
What's the right answer? Which one is the answer?
See.
The answer is to take the vital signs.
So take the vital signs.
Okay.
Jessica, I didn't meet up with your time because my time is getting too early, and I thank God I joined when it was 2:00. I don't know. I didn't come in on time because I was waiting on my time. I'm coming from Texas. So I don't know the number. What was number one answer and number two answer?
So does anybody care to share those with her?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. Number one is
right,
universal cup.
Thank you so much for joining the call today.
I have a
question. If you want
thank you, Jessica.
Help,
thank
you're
you.
Welcome. You're going to have to schedule.
There was about two answers.
Okay, number two is executive function disorder. So number two is A, and number one is universal cup.
Okay, number two is what?
Can you give the answer for number three, four, and five?
Okay. Three is going to be C, a zero entry shower stall. And four is going to be metacognitive skills training, which is letter C. And number five is going to be B, using the ecology of human performance.
Number four, is it D as in dog or boy?
Number four is C as in cat.
Oh, C as in cat. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
No problem. Any other questions, guys? You guys good?
Oh,
well, I mean, is everything on this? I joined late, too. Is everything on the Google Doc is all that she went over today? Like, did she go over anything?
Did you want me to get your email and email it to you if you can't find it?
Yes, please.
Okay, what's your email?
My name is Jaylen, Jaylyn _ Brianna, BRIANNA, the number 3, at yahoo.com.
Yahoo.com. Okay, let me go over that with you. Jaylyn_ Brianna, BRIANNA, 3, at yahoo.com.
Yes, thank you so much.
No problem. I'll go ahead and, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to let you know that
if you need help with autonomic dysreflexia and orthostatic hypotension, OT Mary like really described that really well in her spinal cord injury video.
They put
okay.
it back up. Okay. I thought they took all her videos down.
No, she's back up.
Oh, awesome.
What's her name again?
M-I-R-I.
M-A-R-Y?
No.
M-I-R-R-I. Oh, M-I-R-R-A? Sorry.
M-I-R-I.
Oh, Miri, O-T Miri. Is
yes.
it on YouTube?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And I'll go ahead and email that to you right now, Jalen.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
What was your name so I could look out for? I'm sorry.
My name is Tade, like
okay.
Sade.
Okay.
Tade.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Tade. My email is... Sure, go ahead.
That wasn't
no,
me. I'm listening.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead, Tade.
Yeah, my email is it's my last name, SAGHARI315@yahoo.com. So if you see that, then it's from me.
Okay.
Okay, let me go, Jamie. No problem.
I have a question for you, Tade, if you don't mind helping me.
Sure, go ahead.
I got a little bit lost on number 6, the last one, the thought process. So, because when I'm reading it, I already kind of assumed the diagnosis of the dysreflexia. But
right.
we're not supposed, in this one, we're not supposed to just jump to conclusions, right? We're supposed to figure out all the signs we can decipher in order to decide whether we call the nurse or not?
Right.
Okay.
So
okay.
If it's not needed to call a nurse and you're a professional, you could take care of that, then you take care of that as your profession, you know? But if like a situation happens where it's out of your hands and out of your scope, then call the nurse. Like if the person has a condition where they have to take a medication to reduce the symptoms, then you're not obligated to do that. You have to call a nurse, hey, nurse, I think this person needs their medication. They didn't take their medication. So they have to administer. You can't administer the medication for them. Does that make sense?
It does. It does.
Yeah, so that's the
but
basic.
If you don't know, if you don't know the, if you get all the vital signs and everything and you don't know what it is, then I'm assuming that, you know, it's our duty to contact the nurse and say, you know, I am kind of lost. Can you check
yeah,
the patient
true.
Out?
Because after you do all that you can do in that sense, and you figure out, once you take their vital signs, the picture will be painted for you on what your next step is. This simply is asking
right.
you what's your next step after they're seeing that they're uncomfortable.
This thing is very complicating, you know. There are some questions
yeah.
you will see. You see, they will ask you, they will say, at this stage, call the nurse. Because if she's having a pounding headache and then it's sweating, they will say, call the nurse. Don't do anything. You'll call the nurse. This is just really complicating sometimes. I don't know.
Yeah, because I thought it was automatic dysreflexia. And
yeah.
so then the catheter line is not, you know, bent or anything. Mm-hmm. So that's not the problem. So if you know that the autonomic dysreflexia is not the problem, then you take their vital signs because that's when you know what's going on. If it was orthostatic hypotension, they would have a obviously drop in blood pressure and they get dizzy and all
yeah,
those things.
So we kind of have to know the backstory on some of the possible diagnosis that it is determining.
This is correct.
Please,
yeah.
Where are you guys residing? Where are you? Where is your city or state?
Oh, I'm
in
California.
Oh, you're in California?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
So, where are you?
Are you
in California?
I'm
in Texas. Oh, New Jersey. I'm in Texas.
Okay. Cool.
I wish we can get my. I wish they can get your number so that you can just call. We can just have a little maybe conference talk sometime.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Well,
you could probably set something up on Zoom.
Yeah, my let me give you guys my number. My number is 832.
Hold on.
Okay.
I'm dropping my pencil. Okay.
My number is 832.
Uh-huh.
4-5-4-4-2-6-4.
4-2-6-4. And I'm wondering if kind of what's your name?
Blessing.
Can you spell it?
Blessing?
Yeah, Blessing. As God bless you. Blessing.
Oh, okay. That's a cool name.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you.
And I'm wondering, like, if we could do it, like, just us, or if you guys want us to, like, get the past the OT to help us set something up, or what do you guys think?
No, we can do it ourselves in that case, you know?
Okay.
Just, like,
cool.
Exchange numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they use Zoom, which, I have installed on my computer, and, like, if everybody, you know, you can, like, set up accounts on that and then, like, essentially do the same thing that they have us do now.
Yeah, we can do that. What module are you guys on?
Yeah,
I'm on 4, actually.
I'm on 4.
I'm on module 1.
So module 1. I'm on the 10th, though, so I'm just kind of cramming through everything.
Yeah. Okay, so what are your phone numbers, guys?
So
yeah,
my name.
My number, right?
I got your number.
Okay,
I have
the same
number.
Okay. So what's your phone number?
So my name's Emily.
Emily.
And my number is 707.
Mm-hmm.
494
mm-hmm.
2649.
Okay, and Chris?
So my number is 856-986-4545.
4545?
Yeah, 4545 are the last four digits.
Oh.
Okay.
And the first
my
was
name
856.
Is...
Yep, 856, and then 986, and then 4545.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, my name is Todd A. If you guys have a hard time with that, just call me Tony.
Okay.
747-272-8112.
Are you from Southern California?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I recognize the
area code
number. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right, guys. Well, we'll keep in touch and
yes.
keep on trucking, all right?
Yes.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank
no
you.
Problem. You guys have a good day.
Right. All right. Bye.
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 Bye. Bye.